It's time for a solid hour of business insights and strategies for success on Mind Your Business. And here's your host, the president and founder of Bottom Line Marketing, Yitzhak Saflis.
Welcome to Mind Your Business on 77 WABC Radio in the greater New York, New Jersey area. I'm Greg Greenberg, sitting in for the one, the only Yitzhak Saflis, who's off for the holidays. If you're not listening in your car or home on 77 WABC Radio, so-called terrestrial radio, you might be listening via the internet on mybradio.com or perhaps on the C-Suite Network, which broadcasts all over the world online and on Apple and Amazon and Roku and all those places that didn't exist 25 years ago and now we can't live without. And because I'm merely keeping Yitzhak's seat warm, I don't want to deviate too much from his script. He generally starts his radio show by thanking his listeners for their trust and support, so thanks everybody in advance, and thanks to the producers and engineers to clean up the mess I'm going to make. But I think it's going to be fun because we have a fantastic guest today. My guest is Brandon Steiner, and we're going to be talking about sports marketing. And I'm going to tell you a little bit about Brandon before I bring him on for all those sports fans who may not know him, although most people in the New York area know him. Brandon started Steiner Sports in 1987 with only $4,000 in a one-room office and an intern. By the late 90s, Steiner Sports had dozens of employees and represented most of the big-name athletes in New York. It was about this time that the company expanded its business focus to include marketing collectible items, and he just took that business to a whole new level. He partnered with the New York Yankees in 2004 and provided a way to offer fans authentic Yankees memorabilia and that one-of-a-kind fantasy experience in Yankee Stadium. And since then, Steiner Sports has developed similar partnerships with Notre Dame football. They beat Michigan. Michigan. Yeah, they did beat Michigan.
Michigan. Yes. Yeah, that was a tough game. Oh,
anyway.
Boy. Go Blue. Go Blue. Come on.
All right.
Love both those teams. Love Michigan a little more.
We'll talk about that a little bit more in a second. I know you love Syracuse. He has lots of deals with Syracuse.
Go Cuse.
He's a big orange booster and MSG. We're broadcasting right next to MSG right now. And in 2008, Brandon sold the old Yankee Stadium, literally. Guys sold it off piece by piece. And today, Steiner Sports generates $40 million in annual revenue, around there, he'll tell me in a second, and employs more than 100 people. In 2003, he published his first book, The Business Playbook, Leadership Lessons from the World of Sports. 2012, he published his second book, You Gotta Have Balls. And he's got a new book coming out. He's going to talk about that in a little bit as well. And most importantly, Brandon Steiner is generally credited with inventing the everything bagel at the age of 14 in 1973 at a local Brooklyn bagel shop. Ladies and gentlemen, Brandon Steiner. Welcome, Brandon.
Nice to be here. How are you? And for anybody that's listening, hopefully you've got a pen and paper out and you're looking to actually do something. Hopefully something we're going to talk about today is going to inspire you to either do something or say something. Or think about something that you haven't thought about,
or invent something. So we're gonna start with the everything bagel. Is this true, or is this legend or folklore?
It's true. I mean, you know, and it really is a whole series of things that happened that brought me to that. But I was in a bagel shop, one of the first bagel shops. You know, bagels go all the way back to the early 1900s in this country. So don't be confused. But most of them were underground, and in the 60s and 70s they started becoming overground in stores, which is. I know people think bagels were just everywhere all the time, but that wasn't the case. They were just starting to pop up, and I was lucky enough at an early age, in my paper route, I used to pick up bagels and deliver them to all the people that I delivered papers to, and I got extra tips for that. So the guy noticed it, Elliot, and he's like, wow, you're a really good kid. Would you like to come in at 4:30 in the morning and bake, and then you can deliver your papers afterwards? And I'm like, sure. My mother's like, you sure you want to wake up at 4 o'clock in the morning? I said, yeah, I make some extra money. I still get my paper out down. I'll go to school afterwards. So, of course, I was falling asleep in class and everything else. I was 14 years old, 13.
Well, who needs class when you have bagels?
And meanwhile, I learned how to bake bagels and make bagels. And at one point, the guy came to me and he said, look, the night baker quit, and I'm going to give you a raise. You work every night from 6 to 9, which is perfect. I could play after school, deliver my papers in the morning. And I work a few hours every night. But what happened was we were baking for these routes. There weren't a lot of bagel stores, thousands of bagels. So at night, there was not much to do. You're just baking as people came in. I was a little bored, so I would screw around with all these different seasonings and assortments. And sure enough, I took all the seeds one day, and I just said, let me just try this everything. And I was making braids and everything else and poppy and salt, all these different combinations. And I threw everything on the bagel, and there's the everything bagel. And it started really taking off.
Do you get a royalty? Like every bagel, well, everything bagel that gets sold, you get a half a penny or something like that? Because if you did, that'd be more than the dirt you sell from Yankee Stadium.
We'll get to that, but you know, one of the things you had mentioned about, you know, about learning how to be an inventor, and I highly, highly recommend not being an inventor. What you want to be is an improver, not an inventor. Most inventors, if you look back in history, have not made much money. It's the improvers, the people that saw an item that wasn't really cultivated or developed, and they improved it and found what people needed, found the gap of what people were looking for. Those are the people that made the most money and probably the most thought. So you don't need to be an inventor as much as you want to be an improver. And that's where, you know, your expertise and your diligence combined with your focus on something you really love doing, you figure out what's needed, what's next, what's missing. Boom, you become an improver. And there's a good chance when you become an improver, which is another word for entrepreneur, which I like to think I'm a serial entrepreneur, is you're on your way to some high, you know, some high level success.
That's a great point. A lot of times the pioneers get the arrows and the next guy in line, he reaps the rewards. But let's talk about the beginnings of Steiner Sports. So how did it all come about? Because obviously you're a sports fanatic, but not everybody gets their dream job.
Well, I mean, you know, I was in the restaurant business, had a great run, and I was in the, back in the early 80s, there weren't many sports bars, only two in the whole country, and I left the Hard Rock to open up the Sporting Club on 99 Hudson. It was the first electronic sports bar with big screens, and it had a scoreboard from like Caesar's Palace kind of thing, and we were watching multiple games, and I remember Keith Hernandez walking in saying, you have a problem? Like, you think maybe you have a drug problem? Or how is anybody going to come in here and watch games?
Keith Hernandez asked you about a drug
problem?
Yeah,
because I left
one
of them. Well, I mean, Keith was very much straightened out at that point, leading the Mets on the way. But you got to remember, who was going to sit down and have dinner and watch a game? I just left the most popular restaurant maybe in the history of this city, which was the Hard Rock on 57th Street. And I was down in Tribeca, and there was nobody in the joint. So, you know, it gets a little confusing, but what was great is we had the only satellite dish in Manhattan, and you had to go and really find these games on this big bird. The dish was, you know, gazillion feet wide, and nobody had a satellite dish. So anybody who wanted to watch a game, a lot of people didn't have cable even at that point. And most games were not on TV like they are now. So every sports guy would come in, and that's why I met all these sports guys. That's really how I got started. At the Hard Rock, I would take good care of the sports guys that came in. And then when I did the Sporting Club, you know, a lot of athletes, a lot of sports marketing people that were running teams, everything would come in. I met them. So when I started Steiner, I really didn't know what the hell I was doing. I had $4,000. You know, I told my wife that a couple of buddies of mine want to start this sports company. She says, listen, if that's what your dream is, you know, follow it. I showed up for work that day, and my buddies were like, look, we can't be partners, but you can have that corner office. I was like, I just left my job for this. Are you kidding? And so, you know, about a month later, they said, well, we're moving to another location. I said, where are we moving? He goes, no, we're moving. We'll let you know. We'll call you. So they left me there, 645 Madison. And sure enough, I started my own company. And I was really doing more marketing of players and consulting back then. Most people know me as the collectible guy, but what I've been doing for 30 straight years is the marketing.
So how did you
marketing
get
players?
How did you get from marketing players to marketing the memorabilia? I mean, I guess this is along the lines of, you know, maybe you saw something and you improved on it, because people have been signing bats
Ty
and balls.
You know, Ty Cobb was signing autographs.
Everyone's been signing autographs and signatures, but you just took it to a whole new level. So what sparked that idea for you to improve on this market?
Well, what sparked was my wife telling me that I better get another job, because I wasn't making a lot of money. I started thinking about what else, you know, I could do here, because I was doing a lot of appearances, literally thousands a year, booking players all over. When you speak to older athletes, you know, I called them, I wrote the checks, I picked a lot of them up half the time. I mean, it wasn't it's crazy. I mean, I can't believe how many hours I would spend moving athletes all over the country, literally. But in the early 90s, there was a retail boom. We were opening up at malls and stores, and a lot of the vendors used me to get the players. What sparked me to get the memorabilia thing was really a corporate play. I was looking to add on to the appearance. So I'd book a Roger Staubach, $10,000. I'd make $1,000. But if I brought helmets, footballs, photos, and stuff like that I was always a collector. And I thought it was a natural thing for the guy that booked Staubach to give to his clients, maybe a kid or an employee that was not able to make it. And when I brought that stuff one day, the client said, charge me as much as you want for this. This is better than Staubach. And I was able to charge him 50 points on that. So I was able to buy all that stuff wholesale. So it was $2,500. I charged him $5,000. I made more on the stuff than I did on Roger. And I never thought the collectibles was going to be a brand. I always thought it was going to be a B2B play that I add on to all the appearances I was doing.
But it's interesting because you've actually opened up a brand new market for retired athletes. I know Roger Staubach, you know, he's a gazillionaire selling real estate down in Dallas right now. But a lot of older athletes, they lost their fortunes, you know, from playing days, or maybe, you know, some of the older athletes, they just didn't get paid a lot. And now you've revived them. You've given them a brand new revenue stream, correct?
Well, that's true. I mean, it's amazing what I did in the 90s for so many retired players, finding not only money that way, but 50 other ways to Sunday. Again, I wasn't thinking collectibles as much as a B2B play, incentives. I was the first American Express partner outside of travel, Saks Fifth Avenue, that, you know, we used points to get our products. First gift we did on Amex Rewards was Muhammad Ali gloves. You know, I did Neiman Marcus. I did a Steiner Neiman Marcus catalog. A lot of innovative stuff. And it really enabled players to not only do that, but also meet and greets. You know, I was really the first one to go take that on a grand scale. Also, were you able to go meet your favorite athlete, doing Q&As, videos with athletes, to, you know, basically year-end reports. I'd have athletes with the CEO doing the year-end report on a video. I mean, we thought of so many different ideas at different events, trade shows, and everything else. But, you know, it's amazing how many players were so happy to hear from me back then. Unfortunately, that
Do you
concept,
think it's got out of hand now?
I guess
maybe you were just heading to that. Has it gotten out of hand now where not only is the market to a certain extent maybe glutted with people just signing everything, but now that people, you know, little kids want a signature from a player, and the player's like, no, you can buy it for $20 at the booth, kid.
I mean, I don't think it's that bad. And first of all, players are under a lot of pressure. It's not easy to be them to sort out what's the money grab and what's the right thing to do. If I had my druthers, I'd love to, if I was able to do a symposium for the players to just explain how the whole thing works. Because a lot of them talk about brand building and building a brand for themselves, but they talk it, but they don't walk it. And I always looked at the autograph thing as a brand play if done correctly. It's a money grab. You can make some good money doing it, but you should also respect it enough to realize that's the stuff going up in people's restaurants, bars, offices,
and little,
sports.
And, yeah.
little kids you're having
walls.
A profound effect.
Yes.
So you want to make sure you're doing it right. It's amazing how many players don't sign this stuff right, won't sign. Hey, anytime, imagine if you had a company and you could put your company up in somebody's bedroom or put somebody – I think about what you pay for that.
Yeah.
And athletes need to respect that part of it, but I don't think they fully understand it. And it's confusing to them, frankly.
So what's the formula for pricing, and not just a baseball card, but a signature of a player or some dirt from Yankee Stadium? Is there a formula? Is it scarcity times popularity times, you know, authenticity? So how do you price a piece of memorabilia?
Well, you know, for a long time, I had a nice run there where I was really controlling the pricing, and I could blow players up, and I could blow pricing up, or I can drive pricing a certain way or another. I don't necessarily have that control anymore. There's a lot of people into the game now, so it's a little different. But certainly, I think people trust my opinion on these things. I think the most important thing is, can you withstand the test of time as a player? In other words, have you done enough, regardless of what you do going forward, that would make you a legend or an icon and be remembered for what you've accomplished and what you've done? So that's the first thing I look at is, you know, if I'm going to go make an investment in a player, and I certainly recommend that to people collecting, is like, if the player does nothing else, could you remember
right.
that moment, what have you? And then the other thing is the market that they're in. You know, not all markets are created equal. I mean, not all teams are created equal, regardless of their record. And two teams that have both won are not equal. When the White Sox won in 2006, that's not equal to the Red Sox in 2004, nor equal to the Yankees in 2009. So there's the biggest collectible market, which is certainly New York, and the Red Sox, not a far second. Amazing market up there in Boston. San Francisco, great market, and Chicago, another great one. But again, where the Cubs were unbelievable, set every record for collecting and people buying stuff. The White Sox was so. Well, so
it's,
yeah, you got to be able to read into some of this stuff.
And a lot of times it seems like it's almost like buying a stock, a volatile stock, a NASDAQ stock. So for example, two New Yorkers, we can talk Matt Harvey. You know, if you would have bought a Matt Harvey card his first year, or any Matt Harvey signed memorabilia when he was, the Dark Knight of the Mets, You would have paid up, and then it kind of fell off. And similarly, I remember the Jeremy Lin phenomenon in the Knicks. For a few weeks there, I'm sure that his memorabilia was skyrocketing.
You have no idea.
And then it kind of fell off. So how do you deal with that as a guy who's got to maximize profit while they're hot and make sure he doesn't get caught with too much inventory?
See, I think the most important thing is at this point for me is saying no and sprinting away from some of these characters. Especially somebody like Matt Harvey, I'm not trying to throw gasoline on already, somebody who's already burnt up to a crisp, because Matt's a good guy. I don't think he got it, and his whole approach to New York was wrong. So why would the collectible thing be any different? You know, frankly, I mean, you go in, when you're a guy like that, you should start off really low key, small. It doesn't mean you have to sign a million things, but he had the potential to be a mega star, and you should have started off gradual and small. Because something I did with Jeter at the beginning, and we started off very small, inexpensive, and we always sold out, and everybody was happy, and then you gradually build it up, and he's now one of the more higher-priced collectibles. Jeremy Lin was a fiasco right from the beginning. He was a difficult character. We could have probably made so much more money than we did. I've never had to go give a player money back or take money off a contract. All Jeremy had to do is put his leg up, and because he had hurt his knee that first season, if people remember, and just sign his name, and I don't know. He was just maybe he was shy. Maybe he just didn't want the fame, it seems to me. Then I kind of take it personal. When you got an opportunity like a Jeremy Lin and you leave millions and millions of dollars off the table, like, wow, it's heartbreaking, because you wait for those moments as a sports marketer, not only in collectibles, but so many opportunities worldwide with him that we had been approached on, and not be able to activate all that is heartbreaking. You wait a lifetime for that. Just like with A-Rod, and I like Alex, but you wait a lifetime to get a guy who's going to hit 7 home runs right in front of your eyes. And then, you know, did the steroid stuff and all the other stuff. And his collectibles are blase blah, you know.
Right.
Nothing big, nothing great. And those are the things that hold the industry back. When you think about it, those guys were actually doing this stuff legitimately, you know, Bonds and McGuire. Can you imagine?
Yes. God. Well, along those lines about what holds the industry back as well is, let's talk about quality and fakeries and counterfeits out there. So how do I know that the Yankee Stadium dirt that I'm buying really was under Derek Jeter's feet at the old stadium?
Well, first of all, because we're Steiner and we say so, but also in the case of the dirt, a lot of our dirt is authenticated independently by an independent authenticator and sealed as such.
There's a dirt expert out there.
Yeah, there's a dirt authenticator out there for Yankee dirt, particularly because it's the highest, most sought after dirt, which is the Yankee dirt. And let's face it, I'll show you videos of so many Yankee players and people that go on the field and grab a handful of dirt, put it in their pocket. There's just something sacred about I know people are laughing about the dirt because we've sold over $50 million of dirt and we probably have almost 400 or 500 SKUs of dirt. But let's face it, I mean, you know, Mickey Mantle, Joe DiMaggio, Derek Jeter, Mariano Rivera, Babe Ruth. I mean, think about the people that have walked on that field. I know when I walk on Yankee Stadium field, it's more than just walking on a field. It's special. Right. That place is special. Even the new stadium, not to mention certainly the old stadium, you knew you were walking on hollow ground, and you want to remember it. I mean, we sold more grass than anybody that you could imagine. Legally, we lifted the grass.
They sell a lot more in Colorado right now.
That's true, but mine's even more legal because we lifted that grass from the last field ever at the old Yankee Stadium. We freeze-dried it, but we've done it at Fenway. We've done it at Notre Dame. We've done it at some of the more famous fields, and we get a good markup on that grass.
Can you talk about – you're talking a lot about the Yankees now, and it hurts me because I'm a Mets fan, and we're currently
– You should be hurt. You should be devastated. It hurts mild. I mean, you got to be devastated with that fiasco in Queens.
It hurts.
Yeah.
But let's talk about which sports are doing the best for you, because the sports change over time. You know, some more kids now – when I go to the playground with my kids, I see a lot of international soccer jerseys out there. I know basketball is getting bigger. We keep hearing about the decline in football and parents not letting their kids play football or having them play flag football. So tell me about the trends in sports overall, and how do you stay ahead of those trends?
Well, you're following. You've got to constantly watch the past, too, and keep an eye on that. But, you know, listen,
Do you watch what kids are wearing on the playgrounds?
Oh, yeah. I walk the ballpark. Every game I go to, and I probably go to 100 events a year, you know, 70 or 80 sporting events, and I walk every event from top to bottom just to get a feel for what people are thinking, saying, trying to over-listen to what people are talking about and what they're wearing. I mean, I think that anybody who's in marketing and promotion, if you're not walking around a mall and a supermarket every month, you're not walking stadiums, then you're probably in a white ivory tower and you're probably about to retire because you're going to be extinct. You got to walk and find out what's really going on. You know, you could send out all the surveys you want, but you've got to go see things and feel things for yourself. You know, if Ford was doing sending out surveys, you know, we'd be looking for faster horses and more comfortable carriages. I mean, you know, nobody would be thinking about a car. You got to go out there. You got to see what's necessary and have a vision to understand what people are going to want, even though they don't even know what they want. And I think the way you do that is by getting a strong sense of what people are talking about, what they're thinking. And then with your knowledge and expertise and your heart, you're going to a pretty dark place, which is kind of why I have to limit myself these days in going there, because it's not a comfortable feeling when you're coming up with these improvements or these, whether it be, you know, inventing something. I mean, it's a dark place you go to when you're really trying to do something that's never been done, especially when you do it. No one's seeing it. No one's believing it. So you're working against the current. And I think a lot of people somehow get off track, entrepreneurs, a lot of times, because it is a lot of adversity you're going to face, a lot of bumps in the road.
Here's a question. You know, right now, esports are taking off. Are you going to have people sign their joysticks or their mouses or, yeah, or their computer? Is that because I see on TV now, I see people watching esports. I don't get it. I like watching real sports. But kids today, and even adults, they're watching other people play video games.
Yeah.
So how would you, for example, market that?
Exactly that. I mean, we're already on that. And, you know, trying to get my arms around it. It's not exactly in my wheelhouse, but I brought in some really young kids, two or three kids into my office that are now there full time. And we're looking at it every day. We're trying to find the biggest names and trying to get them to sign some stuff. A lot of them have huge platforms, so that's no problem. And, you know, it's signing joysticks or doing commemorative joysticks similar to the ones they use, having the guys wear certain jerseys and T-shirts and having those signed. And we're trying to get the kids, you know, to try it, and we're doing some sampling as we speak. Esports is not going away. It's a big deal. It'll probably take over all these movie theaters that I'm not sure why people even go into movie theaters anymore. But at some point, it'll take over all those movie theaters and some of those concert halls that are, again, being underused. And you'll be seeing these kids pack in and watch these amazing contests.
And what about football? We keep hearing about the decline of football. How are you addressing that, or are you?
Well, we're trying. I mean, it's a ship that's in very dangerous waters. I mean, I think anybody that has – listen, I think anytime you want to evaluate something, and this is so important in business, is if you step outside yourself and really take a look, it's the only way. You know, if you're all about the love, like, love is blind. So you may want to love certain sports a little less so you can actually see them for what they are. And I think when you look at football – you know, it's a dangerous sport. It's really not a humane sport. It's a sport that creates tremendous harm
but
and danger.
But you have no problem selling the helmets, even though CTE out there.
I'm a money grabber. I mean, I'm gonna go deliver what my customers want. It's not my favorite sport. It's not the sport that I spent a huge amount of time on. I like the sport. I don't love it. I wish, and I'm hoping, you know, that the sport could become safer and maybe it could be saved. I wish that the people that are playing the sport would get a handle on themselves and not get in so much trouble so often.
Political
and
now, too.
And it would enable me to go take more risks. But when you see these guys shooting themselves and getting into all kinds of trouble, it really makes it difficult for me and a lot of other marketers to really, you know, get deep into it. And I think parents aren't far behind me as far as wanting their kids to play.
And what about the political aspect? Because we're currently seeing the Colin Kaepernick commercials on Nike. We're hearing it from the White House with regarding to the kneeling. How do you factor this into your decisions about the merchandise you're going to stock?
Well, you know,
how are Kaepernick jerseys selling?
I don't care. I mean, Kaepernick is to me was a subpar player after he had a couple years of some success. So I don't really know what people think he's given up. Now, the fact that he took the kneel and brought some attention, I give him a lot of credit for that, but I'm not giving anybody credit for continuing to kneel. I think they should move off the national anthem. I think Nike is completely off base in jumping on this campaign. And I like Nike sneakers. I don't like this attitude that every year they've got to become part of a conversation regardless of whether it's negative or positive. I'm not a fan of that. It's a good short-term game, but I'm in for the long game. To me, Nike should be smarter. And I know we're talking about it, so they think all news is good news, and that's kind of what's going on in the country these days. If you can get anybody talking and liking and sharing, well, you're a winner. Well, guess what, Jim? You're not a winner in my eyes today. I think that, to me, I wish Nike would take all these athletes and all this money they have and actually get into the communities and actually start spending the time and the effort and taking their influence and putting it to good use with policemen and enforcement people on one side and people in urban and kids in these urban cities on the other side and rapping and talking it out and spending the money to create and facilitate these things. That would be cool. That would be influential.
All right. Just, and just also do it. Videos of just such. Do it. All right.
Yeah. Don't say it. Okay. Don't say it.
So let's talk about
do it.
We've just been talking about.
Don't get me started on this Nike thing. It just pisses me off when I see people talking, thinking that. I mean, kneeling at a tweet is not work. It's not doing anything. That's lazy. Anybody could do to send out a tweet. And I love LeBron. Listen, he's been influential, but do something on some of these issues. Show up. Get to the White House and confront Trump if you're that upset with him. Is my message to LeBron. You know, get into the communities. Get into Chicago and sit down with kids and police officers. I want to see a player drive an hour and then kneel. Oh, when you're not playing on an off day. Yeah, go drive an hour and then kneel somewhere. See how fast you do it. You're doing it on your time. You got to be there anyway. Out of your way.
Well, certainly LeBron, he set up a school, and it's a nice transition from us. We were talking about football.
Love LeBron, by the way. I want to talk about basketball.
So talk about LeBron versus Steph when it comes to the merchandising thing, because it seems as though basketball is now a national sport.
International.
You can be in New York and support LeBron and support Steph Curry, whereas you know it seems baseball is local. You like your local baseball team, but you know you can be a kid and really still love the Golden State Warriors, because I see those jerseys all over New York. Talk about from a marketing aspect, if you wouldn't mind.
I mean, you're two totally different characters that are totally on the right track and doing a lot of great things, and I have nothing but respect for both of them. You know, LeBron's an action figure. I mean, I don't know anybody emotionally can connect.
Are you selling LeBron dolls, action figures? Get those signed.
I'm just saying, when you look at LeBron, you're almost looking at almost like a cartoon character, but you can't really relate to anybody being that big, that good, that size. When you look at somebody like Steph Curry, well, a more normal size kind of character that you can almost kind of relate to, but you can appreciate the level he's taken and the commitment he's made towards being extraordinary what he does. And you got to like both of what they're doing off the field differently, but both have held themselves very high and done really well in marketing. They've been marketed well. They've been managed well, and they've spoken up when needed. I would like to see them do a little more, obviously, but you know, listen, it's not for me to judge. That's my opinion, because I think they have the kind of influence that could really sway a lot of kids between the two of them. So I'd like to see them do more, because you don't always get an opportunity to have that kind of voice and that kind of impact. I'd like to see them take advantage.
We've talked about pro football. We've just talked about pro basketball. Yeah. Now, so about college versus the pros, because you do have college fans, man, they are loyal. I know you're loyal to Syracuse. You have a court in your house, and I know it's decked out with all Syracuse logos everywhere. What's better? Is better sellers for you? College? Can you get more repeat business with college or with pros? Because professional players, eventually they age out. But, this college is going to be around forever.
I mean, the college thing is complicated with the money. We don't sell college autograph stuff because it's not, the kids aren't allowed to sign.
Is that the Ed O'Bannon?
Yeah,
situation?
I think it's very complicated, and they got to figure this out. I mean, I'd like to see kids be able to sign off on some things, be able to get some royalties down the road. I think the kids are giving away too much, frankly. I think there's got to be some kind of compromise. The NBA, Adam Silver and obviously David Stern, maybe two of the best back-to-back commissioners in all of sports of all time. I mean, both of them are just amazing. You can't say enough about Stern, who's just amazing. His resume speaks for itself. So where the NBA is at, and when you think about where the NBA was at 25 years ago, 30 years ago, 20 years ago, and how he's turned these guys who they didn't even want to have a dress code and they were getting into all kinds of trouble and the bad boys. And now, I mean, these guys are royalty. I mean, they are just gods in neighborhoods and communities. I give the NBA a tremendous amount of credit for where they've taken the game nationally and internationally. And I'm a big fan of the NBA. I'm a big fan of the WNBA, which doesn't get enough props. And more people should be watching these women. These women can ball. They can play. They are really good. And with the stuff that's going on now, the playoffs have just been amazing. My wife thinks something's wrong with me because I'm watching women's basketball. But I love it. I think the game is great. I think Diana Taurasi is one of the greatest women players of all time. Brianna Stewart's going to be a really, really amazing player. She already is. College basketball, I love. College football, I hate the 1 year and done. I hate that.
Yeah, can you talk a little bit more about college? Because you do sell, you know, you have an agreement with Notre Dame. You deal with...
No more. Yeah, moved away from it because I just don't think...
You're supposed to have a good year this year.
I love Notre Dame. I thought they were a great school to work with. It's just that you can't go and sell the kids stuff while they're playing. It just can't. So if stuff's going to get sold, it's going to be going to scholarships, going to be going to charities, and I think it's important that the kids weigh in on that stuff. So the college, I think the college licensing is, there's some money to be made there, but I really love to see that stuff get sorted out.
A lot of people say that the money is ruining college sports, and some people want to pay the college athletes. You know, how much is the marketing aspect and the stuff that you do feeding into this?
I don't think it's feeding into that as much as, you know, we look at the 100,000 and all the TV money and everything else.
So it's TV, not the
memorabilia
money.
You know, when I see coaches making $6, $7, $8 million, and I don't know, it's just, I think the kids, there needs to be some kind of correction. This particular market is awesome. I think college sports is awesome. I think you got to get rid of the one and done and have the kids come up. I'm a big fan of coming up with a college athlete degree. Why do you want to put a 275-pound lineman who doesn't really love school but is interested, why does he got to take biology and calculus, which you know he's not going to do well with? Why not give him a curriculum that will help him later in life that he can handle? There's different degrees for different people. Why not create a college athletic Division I degree that has communications, it's got media, it's got PR, maybe some little accounting or some kind of form of business? So these kids, when they come out, if they decide to play sports, they have some of those necessity things that they're going to need. I just don't understand why you putting these kids in these situations. And, of course, they're going to cheat or want to leave early. Make it a little bit more sexy for them to come and stay at least 2 years. I'm a big fan of three. I think it's not only for the common sense aspect, but just good for the kid. How many athletes go play pro and then they're broke in 5 years? I mean, then stats are off the hook.
Well, why don't we talk a little bit about that, because you do speak to a lot of kids. And I know that, you know, you run a basketball game in your house, and we're going to talk about that in a second. But, you know, when you speak to kids that are coming up and they might be high school phenoms thinking that someday they're going to be signing things and you'll be selling them, you know, what do you say to them? Or, you know, do you encourage them, or do you say, make sure you take your classes, kid, because your signature might not be worth all you think what it's going to be worth?
Well, the first thing I say to them is take your social media a lot more seriously. Stop acting like a child. You have a brand to build, and it started yesterday.
Those things haunt you. We've seen that recently.
Particularly when I'm talking to college athletes, I get around, I speak to a lot of different teams around the country, and talking to them about, you know, the importance of what winning is really all about. And I tell them to utilize, you know, you're paying a lot of money. I know you don't realize it, but you're paying a lot of money for this education. You got to take advantage of it. And also to make sure you're building your brand. I know you're young, you're just in school, but, you know, there are a lot of people going to these games. There are a lot of media. There's a lot of people. You can start building your brand now. And if things don't work out, if you're a star in college, you can always come back to your college and do well in that town, as a lot of players have realized. So I try to get the guys to see that part of it, that when people are in the locker rooms, ask who they are, introduce yourself, make business contacts while you're hot. There's nothing better than when a college alumni comes back and he gets to meet a star on that team. Why not try to reach out to college alumni and make friends, relationships? Those are the people that are going to hire you, support you later on. It's amazing how many times I would go into a locker room, even at Syracuse, and half the kids wouldn't even say hello. Like, why would you say hello to me? Of all people, like, if nothing else, I'm going to probably bring you money at some point down the road. Now, I don't use my Syracuse influence to do business with Syracuse players. I'm there to help. I really make it a point not to do that. But there's so many influential people that come through our campus and all these big schools, and the athletes are oblivious to it. I try to wake them up to it. And their social media is critical.
That's a very good point. We have seen that, you know, come up and bite athletes in the butt recently. So I didn't mention that you have a basketball court in your house, and you play. So talk about this basketball game, because, you know, it's hard. From what I hear, it's hard to get an invite. Who plays in this infamous game?
Well, first of all, you understand, I grew up on top of a butcher on 539 Kings Highway, and my goal and my dream in life was just to have a driveway that maybe I could put a hoop over the garage. That was my goal, and I never really thought I was ever going to have an outdoor and indoor full court hoop. But It's a closed game. There's a lot of characters that have come and played throughout the years. I haven't really talked much about it. It's really one of the first times I've talked about this.
We're breaking news here. Yes,
I'm. You know,
the
it's a low key
crap
thing.
Game in New York.
It's a fun thing. We've taken a lot of players come through. You know, it's a fun game because we're older guys. We're competitive. It's an over 40 game, but we've played with guys like Reggie Jackson, John Wallace, Anthony Mason, Ray Rice comes and plays. There's a lot of guys that are coming and run with us, college players. And, it's
and how would you describe your game, though? Are you do you go to the hoop? Do you go to the hoop hard?
Yeah.
Do you shoot from
my
the
game,
line?
My game is improving. You know, I feel like
either you're ripe
and rotten, or you know, it's like you gotta keep going. And so my game has gotten better. I've gone to the hoop more now the last couple of years. You don't want to leave me open, especially when things are going well. I can get on those. I'm one of those streaky kind of players where all of a sudden you pick your head up and I've dropped four or five baskets in a row. But when things are not going well, that's another problem in itself to get myself out of that. But I'm not going to hurt. I've always been the kind of player. I've always been, you know, I've made the top 90% possible as far as anybody playing with me. So I've always been a mediocre player, but I'm never going to hurt you. I'm always going to play hard, play defense, rebound.
If you were to say my game is like a particular professional player's game, who would you compare your game to? Just in case I do get invited at some point to that game and I have to guard you, just who would you compare it to?
Yeah, that's a good question. Nobody's ever asked me that. I'd like to think I'm a little like I've always looked at myself a little like Clyde. Not as
you don't dress like Clyde. I'm looking at you now. You're not dressed like Clyde.
But
at
not
all.
As good offensively. But a distributor. You know, I like to make a good pass. I can score and at times score well.
So you can swish and dish to use Clyde.
But the thing I liked about Clyde and always respected was that his number one focus was always about the defense and stopping the man and maybe stopping the best player on the court. So I always loved Clyde and loved his game. Appreciated his game a lot. And I like Allen Houston's game a lot, too, when I think about it. You know, if I think about myself as a little bit of a guard, just because he played hard and he was a streaky kind of, he got a hot kind of player.
All right. You mentioned two Knicks. You want to give me your Knicks forecast for the year? Because we're heading up to basketball season. So.
Well, I keep my fingers crossed for the Knicks and Nets. We need good basketball in New York City. The NBA needs it. We need it. We're a basketball town. And
you better listen, cross your toes
like,
as well
you
as
gotta
your
like
fingers.
Some of these young kids that they've gotten. I have faith in the Garden that they'll figure out. I just want to say that to all the Knicks fans out there and Net fans, it's really hard to win in the NBA. It's one of the hardest leagues to win in because there's not a lot of, you know, not a lot of those kind of elite players that can be game changers for you, and only a few teams get them. And you know, the injuries and different factors. And it's not like you get that many players to swap around and switch around like you go to the minor leagues or this or that. I think the NBA is the toughest league to win. So a lot of people get down on the Garden or Mr. Dolan, but I think the guy does everything and anything to win. And there's 20 other teams that are probably worse shape than the Knicks. So I don't think it's like.
But let's bring it back to your business for a second, though, because speaking of the Knicks, unfortunately, we haven't won since 1973, and before that it was 1970. So how do you, as a marketer in New York, have to keep rolling out, you know, the Clyde merchandise and DeBuscher merchandise and Willis Reed merchandise, because, you know, frankly, we haven't had any winners
lately.
Well,
you know, you get Porzingis, then you had Melo for a couple of years. But I think, you know, to me, what I'd like to see the Knicks do, my only comment would be, I think the Knicks still do extremely well considering, but I'd like to see them get more, if they could figure out some players they want to anchor in on, I'd like to see some more individual marketing of the individual player more. And try building up some of these characters and hopefully make a commitment to more of the players so they'd stay long term. I've seen so many, and a lot of these teams, it's a revolving door. And just when you get a little comfortable with a player's game, they're gone. And that's my one downside, even in the NBA in general, is like slow this process down so we can get, you know, so we have time to fall in love with some of these players.
That's true. Well, another New York team, which really has been on the schneid since 1969, since Joe Namath. Pointed on his way out of the Super Bowl, is the Jets. And now the Jets have a new star in Sam Darnold coming on. So why don't you tell me, if you were advising Sam Darnold with his reputation, how he can make the most money in New York, at least in your particular world, in the memorabilia world, how would you advise him?
You know, a lot of agents tell players like that, just win and everything else will take care of itself. I'm not a fan of that. I think you build your brand every day as you're building the process of winning. So I've seen a lot of quarterbacks come in and they're going to rely solely on winning. And that's what I loved about Eli. He built his brand gradually, win, lose, whatever it was. We did it gradually and consistently. And I've had a great relationship with Eli since day one. And I think the players, I say, you know, listen, embrace this, you know, how you eat a big white elephant. That's how I look at New York City, one bite at a time. And I think it's important that you get out into certain circles. Don't overdo it. Don't overplay it. But make friends. Dig your well before you're thirsty. And that's what that would be my recommendation to any of these new players that come into a town like New York, because it can really eat you up. And that is just, you know, make friends, influence people at your pace. Doing nothing is a choice that I don't recommend. Doing too much is a choice I don't recommend. But doesn't mean you can't find a happy medium with people you like and trust and do things in a low-key, smart way.
Well, people like and trust you, and you have a new book coming out. I want to hear about the new book.
Yeah, I mean, this is a different kind of book, Living on Purpose. It's got some sports stuff in there, but it's really for people that have, you know, starting to find their way to success. If you're in your 30s.
As we are, you and I, right?
And you know, listen, I learned the hard way, but I think if you're concerned about what you want your approach to be when you get older, then this is going to be the book, because most of us spend 95% of all of our waking time figuring out how to get the money grab, how to make more money, how to get more money, how to make more friends so you can make more money. And then you wake up one day and you wonder why you don't have a lot of friends, or why your marriage is on the rocks, or why your kids don't talk to you, or why you're not healthy and you feel like crap. And I think this book gives you some really good alarms that you can set off and some adjustments that you can make so that when, as you age well and can do it with the people that you love, and you've given the respect to those people the same way you've given the money grab the respect. You can't go and spend 95% of every waking moment from the ages of, let's say, 10 or 15 to 40, and then all of a sudden wake up at 40 and not have anything but just money and think you're going to be happy. You should be very disappointed. And that's what this book elaborates on my story. Which the last book, You Gotta Have Balls, was about the story how I built Steiner. And this is the book, what happened after I sold Steiner, made a lot of money, and how I felt that day from, and then the next 10 years, what I did about it.
And why did you sell Steiner? I mean, was it a pure money grab?
No, it was not at all, actually. It was because I wanted to build something bigger, and I knew I needed a partner to do it, and I found a really good company to help me facilitate those dreams and hopes I had for Steiner. And they did do those things for me, because it gets complicated as you grow and get bigger. It's very difficult to do it without a bank or without a loan or partners. And I thought that was a really very dynamic company with a lot of great best in category companies.
Do you still get up every day and want to sell memorabilia like you did when you first started, when it was just you and the intern? I mean, yeah, because you just like in sports, you know, you're a veteran now, and you might see someone coming up in the business. And do you feel like you still have the same hunger?
You know, I wish I did. I mean, but you know, I have other
it's
responsibilities.
Hard, yeah.
I would love to get up every day and just. I still love making a sale, especially to somebody I know with how happy it's going to make them. Especially if I can find a customer, I love doing it. But I have other responsibilities, which is strategic relationships, setting up new paths for the industry or for my company, finding new ways to, you know, create businesses. Other things on my mind. Do I wake up every day nervous and fired up? Yes. Do I wish sometimes I could just go in the office and only have to deal with one or two employees and just get on the phone and start selling some stuff? Yeah. I mean, who wants the headaches of running a whole company? You know, we have a $40, $50 million company, and there's a lot of stuff that goes with that. But, you know, I'm still fired up. I mean, I feel as good now as I did when I was 40. And I feel good. And when I'm not feeling good, or when I'm not feeling the energy or excitement, I'll find something else to do. It's cool. I mean, I have no need to do stuff that I don't like or don't want to do anymore. I have no desire to do that, nor do I wake up and want to be somebody else when I wake up in the morning. I'm happy with who I am, happy with the life I've been given, actually blessed and grateful. Frankly, I have a lot of gratitude to the support I've gotten, because, you know, 30 years is not easy to keep something like this going, especially it's not like the most necessary thing that we do over at Steiner Sports. But I have a lot of gratitude for a lot of customers that support it.
And it seems like you also you have a podcast. You have your own TV show, which you stream out. So, you know, it seems like you stay ahead of the curve technologically as well. You know what I mean?
I found some great young kids. I mean, a lot of people talk about the young kids. And I mean, I do mentor a lot of kids, but I have a bunch of young kids that are mentoring me. I have 150 pods I've already done in the last year and a half. I mean, I'm active. You know,
you're not
I'm
averse
on social.
To the new technology.
Nah,
because,
I love it.
You're
what
in the
an opportunity!
Business, but it what? Seems as though you're grasping the new technology.
What an opportunity to talk to your customers and actually find out what they're really thinking. I mean, I don't get the. I mean, I have thousands and hundreds of thousands of customers. What an opportunity to go see what's really going on instead of hiding out in the corner office and hoping that some marketing person tells you what's going on.
When eBay came around and they were selling collectibles, you know, some of them might have been yours, some of them might be other people. How scared were you of that technology? Or did you just say, you know, some this is another challenge, it's another competitor, the internet, you know, they can sell stuff too. I'm gonna have to figure it out.
No, I was excited about it. I mean, I think you have to get excited about the change and all different changes in your life. You got to try to find excitement and you got to dive into it. But you know, we were the first company to do a website. I had no idea what a website was. I just had a really good friend that told me I better do it, and I trusted him and I did it, and I'm glad I did. So when eBay came around, it was really the best thing for us because we had one of the few really good names in collectibles. And you know, when people were communicating about why this, why that, our name was constantly coming up in a good way. So eBay really helped us. They probably hurt us a little now because of the pricing. You know, there's some people on there that are selling fake stuff, and it's not a very well guarded website, which is my real problem with eBay.
So, all right, we've gone from you inventing the everything bagel all the way up through the internet age into where we are now with podcasts. So I just want to finish up a little bit. So what's next? You got a book. You're doing your podcast. You got a radio show. You're still selling memorabilia. You're running full court in your backyard. You know, and you're doing so many things. So what's next year?
Well, first of all, you know, I'm constantly looking for what's next. I haven't quite got all the answers. I don't know if anybody has all the answers. I mean, I'm still trying to figure it out, man. But I think. You know, I think that it's really listening to some of the customers. I think I've got to figure out how to get a more diverse line of products for them. I got to figure out ways for them to sell their products because a lot of people have a lot of stuff that they want to sell, and I have a lot of people that want to buy stuff that's not normal or simple. So we're trying to figure out ways to, you know, get everybody together to be able to trade and sell a lot easier. I'm very big on this next book and on my platform. There's always so much learning and so much things to come up. I'm probably more excited about the unknown than having a strategy and a real specific plan right now, because I think there's so much change right in front of us, and I want to be ready for it and open-minded as opposed to be stuck on a particular strategy. And, you know, part of it is just, you know, I like what we're doing. I like some of the stuff we're doing. I want to keep doing it on the level we're doing it. Because I, you know, I can't take that for granted. I don't want to just assume that that's good. There's a lot to keep an eye on as players come and go, leagues change, things change, and customers have needs. And I want to make sure I stay on top of that. So, and you know, I want to be a good person. I try to do as much as I can. You know, charity wise, I have a lot of initiatives in building courts and have two homes in White Plains that my wife and I manage and oversee with kids that don't have a place to go. I have a big scholarship at Syracuse that's going to take underprivileged kids and enable them to go to a school like that. You know, the charity stuff is a big deal for me. The money grab isn't as big a deal. So a part of every day for me has to be, you know, trying to figure out how I can add value to this world and support others. And help people that can't help themselves.
I love it. All right, one more thing before you go. I want to get the power rankings from you. All right, so just quickly, how are the Yanks going to do heading into the playoffs?
Well, I look at the Yanks as a faith and fear proposition. You know, I'm trying to find faith here, and they may find it. This is going to be a difficult road for them because, you know, the injuries, and sometimes things just don't work out. Not because the team wasn't tight, not because the Yankees didn't do everything they possibly could. But it's gonna have to be a miraculous kind of turnaround at this point.
Win the pennant or not?
50-50.
All right. What about the Jets? Jets.
You know, they're gonna be an 8-8 team. They have a little bit of the easier schedule, and I guess Jet fans will probably be happy just the fact that they won some more games, or almost as many games they lost. But they're not gonna win more than 8 games.
And it hurts me. All right. Giants, Saquon?
Giants may surprise you a little bit. You know, that organization is so buttoned up and tight. I love the way they operate. This probably is the coach that they needed. Eli's got a chip on his shoulder, and you've got a better offensive line and obviously a super, super running back, which will enable Eli to do better with more protection and a good runner. I like them to make the playoffs. How far they go, I'm not enough of a football guy to know, but they're making the playoffs. And anytime you have Eli in the playoffs with the ball healthy, with a good offensive line, some receivers, is very dangerous.
All right. Well, a little bit of hockey here. We haven't talked about it yet. Rangers.
Rangers are going to be young. They'll be exciting to watch. There's nothing like youth. Youth sells in this market. I think teams are starting to realize more and more that, you know, don't necessarily go crazy on the free agents as much as go crazy on getting young, hot, you know, fast, good players. And the Yankees learned that. I think the Rangers will see that this year. They'll have their moments. They'll creep into the playoffs, but, you know, don't expect a lot.
Islanders, do they sell merchandise or do they just keep selling Bobby Nystrom jerseys?
The Islanders are trying to figure it out. And they, by the way, we haven't talked about this, but they probably hired the sleeper of all sleepers in this offseason with a lot of new coaches and everything else. Lou Lamoriello is probably one of the greatest GMs in all of sports. I mean, he's a legend. He's a Hall of Famer. And if anybody could turn things around or stabilize things, it's him, and he will. I put all my money on Lou. I really, really like this guy. He's a great, great, underrated, very much so, sports management guy. He gets it, and the Islanders will make the playoffs, and it's just a matter of time, just like what he did in Toronto, like he did with the Devils. He figures out the formula to win, and by the time the Islanders can get one home, which hopefully will be in Long Island or Roosevelt, whatever it is, the Islanders will be exciting this year.
Nets. Brooklyn Nets.
Same thing as the Knicks. You know, they're trying to
find... We'll talk about the Knicks in a second.
Trying to find their way. I think if D'Angelo Russell is healthy, I like his game, and he's one of those guys. Maybe this could be a breakout year for him if he can stay healthy. I mean, I think it's really, really key. I just don't know. I don't know where they're going, but they seem to be one of those 20 teams that just seem to have a bunch of guys that some good, some bad, but not enough to compete with the Bostons and Sixers and Lakers. And
can they compete with the Knicks?
Yes.
Tell me about the Knicks. Give me your Knicks forecast.
I like the Knicks. I mean, they have the two young kids.
I know you like them, but can they win?
I like the Knicks a little better than the Nets just because I like both their draft picks are really strong. Knox is a scorer. He's going to be good. The question is Porzingis going to be back? If he doesn't come back, I still think they'll probably win 30, 35 games, maybe squeak into the playoffs even. But they're on their way. They're on the right track.
And if the Knicks need someone, and would you raise your hand and you say, look, I play like Allen Houston. I play like Clyde. If you need someone to swish and dish, Brandon Steiner's here. No?
No. No, I'm not even taking those. I'm not even taking those foul shot contests because I'll be scarred for life if I miss that free throw and don't get the half court $1 million shot. Although I did have many dreams that I hit that. I think I can get on the court and hit that half court shot, just because that's the kind of way my mind works. But, I love Madison Square Garden. I actually like the Barclays Center too. There's nothing like the Garden. I mean, it's just it does make. You know, it just takes things up a notch when the Rangers and Knicks just takes things up a notch, and I'm more hopeful than fearful.
And if they ever knock down the Garden, you're going to sell it off piece by piece,
Well, I did. I mean, I was fortunate enough to work with the Garden to sell off when they did the transformation, which they did a great job with that building, by the way. I mean, it's really one of the nicer buildings, and we did sell off some of it, and so hopefully that won't happen for a long time because that building's in pretty good shape.
All right.
Nice shape. As in all the stadiums, when you think about the whole New York area, I mean, how great do we have it here in New York? I mean, how nice are these stadiums? I mean, you can't.
Nice stadiums, no championships.
I know, but it's not. Listen, not all winning is. It's not everything. Going and enjoying good competitive sports where teams are trying and playing hard count for something. When you were a kid, all you cared about was if your team won that night. You didn't care if you won a championship. That's an adult thing. We throw out people, but you want teams to go play hard. I mean, I still love this Yankee team, whether they win the World Series or not. They came out, they played hard, they were exciting. There's nothing wrong with it.
And it's also about being able to talk about sports with your father and your kids. It's generational as well, and I think what you do adds to that.
Well, thank you. I appreciate the time. It's been great talking with you. Thank you.
Thank you for coming on. We've been speaking with Brandon Steiner of Steiner Sports. You've been listening to 77 WABC Radio. I'm Greg Greenberg, sitting in for the great Yitzhak Soflis. Thanks for listening.
77 WABC Radio presents Mind Your Business, hosted by founder and president of Bottom Line Marketing Group, Yitzhak Soflis. Mind Your Business focuses on business and marketing strategies for success. Tune in every Sunday night for this intriguing weekly radio show that's chock full of business insights and marketing strategies that will help you get ahead of the game. Host Yitzhak Soflis has been producing pioneering and creative marketing work for over two decades. He leads a team of marketing experts who help their clients build their brands and grow their businesses. Now, he and his guests offer their business and marketing expertise to you every Sunday night on Mind Your Business.
Hey, Joe, give me a minute. I'm going to run the numbers and circle back next week. Post it on Facebook, LinkedIn. Just get it up there.
You're great at what you do, and you're busier than ever. We get that. Imagine if you could devote every minute of your day to running your business and taking it to the next level. Enter Bottom Line Marketing Group. Bottom Line Marketing Group focuses on making your company look great, so you can focus on growing your business. To see some award-winning projects produced by Bottom Line Marketing Group, visit www.bottomlinemg.com. That's www.bottomlinemg.com. Or call CEO Yitzhak Saflis on his direct line for a free consultation at 718-412-3505. That's 718-412-3505. Bottom Line Marketing Group, marketing solutions to grow your bottom line.
This podcast is a part of the C-Suite Radio Network. For more top business podcasts, visit c-suiteradio.com.